play a harder game. Stakes can get real high. Down here when something happens, it tends to happen fast. People live wide open like nothing's gonna last. Down here, whoa, down here. Down here it's scars and tattoos and a quickness in the eye. Measures every stranger, every passerby. Down here the time is always now. Nobody's making plans. So jump the fence, hit the streets, and get it while you can. Down here, down here. Down here there's darkness in the daytime, where the morning sun don't burn the night away. Down here there's something moving in the shadows, where the bull counts the dues that he's been fed. Down here. Down here it's like a heartbeat pumping in the heat. You can feel the blood rushing right beneath the streets. Down here it's like a hunger that can eat a man alive. Down here it's right down to the bone. It's the struggle to survive. Down,
down here there's darkness in the daytime, where the morning sun don't burn the night away. Down here there's something moving in the shadows, where the devil counts the dues that he's been paid.
Down here. Down
here. Let's see here. Oh, I got my mic turned around. Yeah. Okay, let's get started again here. That was John Cadley, C-A-D-L-E-Y. Title of that album is The Closer I Get, recorded evidently in 2007. A lot of good songs on there. A lot of good songs on that John Cadley, should I say album? Boy, that dates me. That really dates me. Maybe CD. Haven't caught up with the times, but I'll tell you one thing, the times have caught up with me. This is Terrible Tommy in the bunker, and they tell me I shouldn't call it a bunker for security reasons. I should call it, what do they call it? Well, hell, I'll just call it what it is, a basement. The guy who was telling you how to survive, he says you shouldn't call it a bunker. That attracts attention. Well, so I'm in the basement. That's not very romantic, is it? Hey, it's February. Lost a couple of months there, and I haven't been drinking yet today either. Hey, it's February the 19th, 2014, Wotan's Day. David Lane's favorite day, so all the day today when you're working around or doing whatever you're doing, once in a while, think about good old Dave. He was one of our really good buddies and order buddies and the whole bit. And he had spooks in the sky, but he liked those Viking spooks, Thor and so forth. Yeah, so just think about old Dave Lane today while you're running around and all the years he gave up of his life for us, and how he was murdered by the federal rats, pigs. You know, I don't even want to insult pigs, because these guys are worse, a lot worse than pigs. Pigs are pretty good animals. They're very smart animals. When I was a kid, I raised pigs, and they're smarter than most of the dogs, I'll tell you that. A lot of people don't know that. And pigs are not dirty either. They're only dirty when you leave, the pens get filthy and they don't have any place else to lay. And the only reason they get lay in the mud is because it's cool and they get hot in the summer. So don't insult the pigs.
This land is yours. You must protect it. protected. If necessary, with your lives and your children with their lives. Don't discount your enemies. They will be back. And if your house is burned, build it again. If your corn is destroyed, replant. If your children die, bear more. If they drive you out of the valley, live on the sides of the mountain, but live. You always look for leaders, strong men without faults. There aren't any. They're only men like yourselves. They change. They desert. They die. There are no leaders but yourselves. That strong people is the only lasting strength.
Very true words, even if they are from a movie. Don't ever forget it. You got it? Get it? Don't ever forget it. You know, one thing that meets my eye on the news is that, and this is something you might think is very simple, but I don't. Because I've got a high school, like I've told you, within a mile of me that looks like San Quentin. In fact, I think it's worse looking than San Quentin. It's a giant edifice with gun towers and everything. Obviously, they're not using them for gun towers yet. But it's pretty ominous. Psychologically, these kids are just scooped up in the school buses by the hundreds every day and thrown into this prison, which very little education is going on at all, that they can use to live and prosper. But the other thing that pisses me off is that whenever we have bad weather, instead of saying the school's going to be temporarily closed due to bad weather, they say it's in lockdown. Now, what a hell of a thing to say when lockdown is the exact words they use for a prison, state or federal prison. They're in lockdown when the inmates rise up and fight each other or fight the staff or whatever they do. Lockdown. So they say the schools, even grade schools, are in lockdown. Now, you know, if I had kids in school, I've had 6 kids in school over my lifetime, but still, they never said lockdown when my kids were going to school. Of course, they were going to school in Southern California, so the weather, you know, never got really that bad to where that one might have come up. But certainly here in the Midwest it does. So if you live in the Midwest and you're a parent, you might want to go down to the PTA some night and raise hell about you don't like that term lockdown for kids. It sends the wrong message. Or maybe it is the right message. Maybe that's what they actually think. Well, here's a little tidbit from history. The first company that started using the payment plan here in the United States, it was Singer Sewing Machine Manufacturing Company. Just a little tidbit there in case you ever go on a game show. Well, you know when those brave pilots from England, the United States, and so forth were bombing the working class neighborhoods of the cities in Germany, they tried to make, you know, excuses. Well, we missed the factory and we hit a few working class neighborhoods by accident. No, it wasn't accidental. Number one, as I've told you before, the whole air attack on Germany was planned around bombing neighborhoods, working class areas of the cities, not the manufacturing facilities. Now, they did this almost to a fault because Germany learned real quickly that they're going to have to produce synthetic oil, which they did, and towards the end of the war, they were totally into manufacturing synthetic oil that they didn't have to have external oil. But the bombers didn't attack these synthetic oil factories? No, they didn't, which actually would have brought the war to an end months or maybe a year before it did. They were busy bombing, as a pattern of warfare, civilian targets all over Germany, in the urban areas especially. And they had no excuse of what they were doing, because the Spitfire planes had what many people didn't know about, and didn't know about till later. They had 3D, yes, 3D color cameras on those planes. So there's no excuse of weather and all that kind of stuff. They knew exactly who they were bombing, and they were punishing the German people, which usually happens. The enemy attacks the general population to get them to, I don't know what they expect them to do. They've got no weapons to rise up and do anything. But they do that as a pattern of war. So when they talk about, well, we want to help humanity and save all these people, no. Their act of war is to kill as many civilians as possible, like they do today in Syria and so forth, like they did in Iraq and, what, Mogadishu, or what do you call it, that place where they had that giant battle and they shot up the town with phosphorus and depleted uranium ammunition, and birth defects are going through the roof now from the people who lived there. Anyhow, it's a little point in history. Anybody tells you, well, they didn't know quite what they were doing. They couldn't quite see what they're bombing, and it wasn't precise like it is today. Bullshit. They knew exactly what they were bombing. Now, here's a clever little piece of corporate propaganda about the oil reserves in Mexico.
Thing is, oil companies haven't really been that interested in Mexico's fees. Phil Flynn is an analyst with Price Futures Group.
Mexico is sitting on a mountain of supply of both oil and gas, but yet their production has been falling year after year.
So the idea now is to attract companies by letting them share in the oil profits. If that works, 87 billion barrels of oil could come to market. Chris Lowe is chief economist with FTN Financial.
It should result in cheaper, more abundant energy, which is beneficial to U.S. consumers, of course, through lower gas prices, but also U.S. manufacturing.
And that means improved competitiveness. This doesn't, of course, address environmental costs of all that carbon. In any case, this all supposes that Mexico's oil will come online. Sovereign control over oil is a point of pride in Mexico, and letting go of that won't happen without a fight. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Now, did you read between the lines on that? Mexico's got very large oil reserves, but they have nationalized their oil, and they want to keep it for themselves, of course, and they don't want to give it away, like what happens when they lay the place open for foreign oil companies to come in and rape the profits. And it's interesting, the double talk you hear in something like this. Every country in the world should be jealous of its oil reserves or coal reserves or anything else, and not just allow the corporate predatory capitalists to come in and rape them, and people end up with very little. Of course, you have to, obviously there's corruption, massive corruption in Mexico, but a lot of them, corruption in Mexico is a spillover from New York, which is always, I mean, the corporates of all the United States have always been into Mexico, manipulating the thing, everything, ever since they control the railroads in Mexico. So a lot of Mexico's problems are because of intervention by American corporations, and they have been for a long, long time. Because they tend to feed corruption. They like corruption so that these corporations can buy off people. But there's another example of twisting the news. That's the main thing I wanted you to get, and how to read between the lines on this kind of stuff. One of the TV stations this morning, they were extolling these different presidents. And like I've told you before, if you really get down and studying each one of the presidents, they were all psychopathic war criminals. Even the most peaceful ones. And of course, the most violent ones, the ones who kill the most people, are the ones we build the statues to and build the highways to and name everything after and the schools after them. Yeah. Well, this morning they was going on about Eisenhower. Well, Eisenhower certainly was a psychopathic killer that was turned loose on Europe. And after the war, he deprived the thousands and thousands of German soldiers that were left with no housing, no food, living on the ground, digging holes in the ground. And that information is out there. And they had the supplies and warehouses full of food, but Eisenhower wouldn't release the food. So just another one of these guys that they push, that we're all supposed to venerate these guys. They're wonderful. These leaders were wonderful. Well, if that's your idea of wonderful, you have a problem. And the rumor that Eisenhower was a Jew, well, if he walks like a Jew, acts like a Jew, talks like a Jew, he's certainly pretty close to being a Jew, if not a Jew. Like my wife used to say, you don't have to be a Jew to be a bastard, but it helps. Oh, yeah, about that bombing of the civilian targets, making it a major part of the war. And why they would do that? Old Bomber Harris, the British officer in charge of that, well, to use up more ammunition and weapons, because there's tremendous profits in ammunition and weapons, and the longer they could keep it going, the more weapons they could sell. Now, the other theory of mine is, and you know I have theories, and don't tell anybody, but I think they were prolonging the war so that they could get the atomic bomb ready in time to bomb Germany. Remember Morgenthau, the Jew, wanted to get FDR to drop the atomic bomb on Germany. That was the plan. So the longer they prolong this war without bombing all these artificial oil manufacturing centers, because at the end, after they did start bombing those synthetic oil manufacturing places, the war came to an end because the German army had no oil. Nothing could run. You can't fight a war without the oil. That was the main reason that war could have gone on for a long time if they'd had the oil and the synthetic oil. So just think about that. A lot of times a lot of people don't think really how bastardly these people in power can be. I mean, it's so outlandish that it's like a Frankenstein movie. I mean, and people say, oh no, he couldn't have been that bad. No, they couldn't have been that evil. Well, believe me, they could be beyond evil as far as I'm concerned. And so delaying the end of the war for a few months would have gave them time to complete the testing of the atomic bomb. And they would have dropped it on Germany. What do you think about that, boys and girls? What do you think Europe would be like today if the United States had dropped atomic bombs in the middle of Europe. Those are your leaders. Those are the people your kids are taught to emulate and worship in the schools. And even have a President's Day should be a day of infamy for most presidents, whether it be Abraham Lincoln or who it may be. I think I sent out an article to you yesterday about how the Jews are going on and on of how Abraham Lincoln was so much like what Jews perceive him to should have been. I mean, I'm getting tongue-tied here, but in other words, they loved Abraham Lincoln. Yeah. Think about it. Now, you probably read about this latest trial where the white man, Mr. Dutton, stopped into a 7-Eleven or some store like that with his girlfriend, and some rowdy blacks were pulled in beside him, playing the typical rap crap, and he objected to it. And then he thought he saw them flash a gun, and he shot up the car and killed the kid. Well, he was just found guilty. Anyhow, I got a little disturbed there with the phone call, but I listened to a lot of different sources, and a couple of the black radio sources on XM radio, pretty interesting, some of the stuff they come up with. And when they say that they try to play down race, well, of course it was race. If you believe that that guy would have shot up that car if just some white, loud teenagers pulled up beside him, you're dreaming. And so many times the blacks are correct about this. You know, it's people will deny they're racist, especially the respectable people that go to church and all that kind of stuff and see spooks in the sky. Let's listen to a little bit of this commentary and see what you think.
Rig out, if you ever get in trouble yourself, call Tom. Also, Dr. Gallis, scholar and activist, who has become sort of the HLN on Twitter herself. And when these cases come up, she's always moderating a great deal of discussion about them. They are our dream team. Michael, you still with me?
Yes, sir.
The Michael team brought up the issue of race not being, you know, a factor, brought up as a factor in this. Who'd like to react to that? Though the prosecution not bringing it up. Who'd like to react to that?
Well, I can start. I mean, you know, just from the legal perspective of the prosecutor's duty not to inflame a situation, if you will, you have to be very careful in how you use race. Obviously, it's there because you know the defendant is black and the shooter is white. But to harp on that, you know, in the sense that there's nothing that the prosecutor has to prove with regard to race. In other words, he doesn't have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that Dunn was motivated by the defendant's race. And so for him to do that, and if he were to get a conviction, it would be wide open for a reversal on appeal.
That's exactly right, and you know, that's a great point. But think about it reversed. If it's an African American defendant shooting a white person, and they keep bringing up the fact he's African defendant, that can have some really nasty consequences with people carrying around minor to major prejudices. So you try to base it simply on the facts. On these are two human beings, and let's figure out what these human beings were doing. It's offensive in a million ways. I mean, I just, in this murder case, my jury still out. In this murder case that I tried, we got 80 jurors we brought in to try to get our jury selected. That's not right. It was 120. And out of that, there were a grand total of two African Americans in Yamatill County. Now, that includes East Palo Alto, which is highly African-American, and some other areas that are. And if anybody who says that racism involves has not been in a courtroom and seen the percentage of people who are being arraigned and charged with things who are African-American, and then seen the number of African-Americans who show up for jury duty. So it's always present. It's always present the way the system is working. It's horrible, but it's there.
Thank you for your call, Michael. We appreciate you. Janet in North Carolina. Janet, God bless you. On there with Dr. Goddess, Attorney Tom Kelly, and Attorney Michael Hardy. Go right ahead, Janet.
Yes, hi, Mark.
Hi.
I'm just joining the conversation, so you and your guests may have already discussed this. But what disturbs me the most about this verdict, aside from the obvious, that it sends the message to the next Michael Dunn that you must finish his job. You can't leave any witnesses behind. Because I do truly believe that those young men weren't there to testify and at least tell their side of the story. There would be no justice. And we're upset about the verdict. We know that Jordan Davis's family did not get the justice that they were looking for their son. But I can't take the solace in the verdict itself, because this tells me that you have to finish the job to some nut out there who see some black kids that they may have issues with, and just make sure that they kill them all so they can't testify, so they can use the stand your ground defense.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just upsetting to me.
Yeah.
And that's all I have to say.
Well, I hope you could understand that, but my point is that once in a while, it behooves you to, if you've got XM or Sirius satellite radio, to tune in once in a while on these black commentators, because there's some interesting things come up and some interesting logic comes up. Now, this last gal, so like I say, there's a lot of truth that can be heard on both sides, and you can't blame black people for being for black people and pointing out to the problems in the system also, and sometimes they even parallel our problems a little bit, you know. But the gal's right. She said, well, the mistake he made, he didn't kill all of them, you know, not leave any witnesses. Well, of course, there were witnesses in the immediate area anyhow. But the point is, what she's saying is that the whites are scared to death of niggers. They're scared to death of them. And here's a middle-class guy, maybe upper-middle-class guy, that been out on a holiday and spending his money and all that kind of stuff, and these guys scared him. And so maybe he'd had a few drinks. I don't know. But you see, this fear is spread among white people all the time without any kind of training or advice to not be afraid of these people. And if it comes to push and shove, you don't shoot them in front of a convenience store. So when the blacks say that, these whites are overreacting, well, Zimmerman wasn't white, but he overreacted. You know he did. I know he did. He could have handled that guy, Trayvon, with pepper spray, or maybe even just physically. Or so what if he'd have got a broken nose? I mean, all the trouble he's been through, he'd have been better off to have had to worry about a broken nose than all this court time and ruining his whole life. When with a pepper spray or maybe a baton or something simple, he could have had Trayvon running the other way. So you're going to see more and more of this to our whites who are scared to death of blacks. See blacks coming down the street, they go across to the other side of the street. Well, that just inflames the blacks. They love that shit if you're afraid of them. But if you walk down the street and blacks are walking towards you and you look them right in the eye, not with any particular nasty look on your face, just a cold stare, I'll bet you that you won't have any problems. I do that all the time. I've had four or five diggers coming down the street, and you're uneasy. Of course you're uneasy. And you just look at them, give them that dead stare, and then go on. But whites they're trained to be afraid of niggers. It's amazing. And you'll see these white kids now, four or five young white kids, trailing down the street behind one black guy. The black guy's leading the group. Well, of course, most of this comes from television, movies and stuff, where they portray the black guys as being the baddest asses in the world, which they're not. Most of them can't hit the broadside of a back bank barn with a gun. They don't. There'd be a hell of a lot more blacks dead in the ghetto if these guys could hit anything. So just the fact, maybe even that you're going to come to a situation where blacks going to fire a gun at you from a distance, you're most likely going to survive. And if you're the kind of shot a white man should be, he's done. But anyhow, this fear of black people has been spread all over. Now, on television and everything, they'll say, well, you go to prison, you get to meet Bubba. Well, you go to prison, you meet Bubba, you form yourself and fashion a weapon, and you cut his heart out. And that's the end of that. I mean, you know, as long as white people act so goddamn chicken when black people are around, and the fact that they have to almost give reverence to blacks when they come into a public place where you're in a bar and one black guy comes in and everybody hovers around him, fawns, and he's wonderful, but then when the black guy leaves, most of the time they're going to be making snide comments about the nigger. It's white cowardice. We're surrounded by white cowardice. I just got a call from a lady by the name of Janet. I won't give you any more information. She's a good woman, and she's done a lot of good for a lot of white people. But we had our differences about this Tea Party thing. And in fact, she was saying Tea Bagger. I call them Tea Party. I forgot to tell her I call them Tea Party. But anyhow, we had a little discussion this morning, and I'll put it on here and see what you think. Yeah, I don't know what I was thinking about when she going on and on about Teabagger. I never call him Teabagger. I call him the Tea Party. In fact, it seems to me like most people I hear call him the Tea Party, not Teabaggers.
So I wanted to elaborate what I said about the Tea Party about 2 months ago. Tom, I and all the people that go to those meetings are firmly aware of who runs the show. They are not naive about this. I personally know two people who've converted from a Tea Party person to a white nationalist. And the last time I was at a Tea Party meeting here, I'm quite open about who I am. I mean, I don't shout it from the rooftop, but I'm quite open about it. I had one man ask me to join his Facebook page, and I had three others ask me for their email address, and we still correspond. The only thing is, when you use that term teabagger, you're falling into the hands of the Jew, because, you know, teabagger is a sexual derogatory term towards people. And it borders on beating up white people, because, you know, the Jews don't beat up the Mossad. They don't beat up each other.
Well, one thing we have to remember here is the Tea Party is funded by the Koch brothers, these super billionaires that are the richest men in the United States. This is not a grassroots outfit at the top. The money's coming from these capitalists.
It's not coming to any of the Tea Party meetings I've been to, because...
Well, no, because they do it behind the scenes. It's not... They're not going to make it evident. They don't talk about the Koch brothers and a lot of their criminal activity and so forth, and the fact that they're the genesis of the family money came from their deal with Joseph Stalin back in the 40s and 30s and so forth like that. And then they had a change of heart and suddenly became right-wingers. But the point is, I've seen that big bus of theirs. They call it Prosperous America or something like that. That's their cover, and they came. I was right here in town, and they. I wanted to see what the Tea Party people were doing. Number one, they pray for most of the meeting. God, I didn't think they'd ever get done praying. And then this bus pulls up, at least $100,000 bus, probably $200,000 by today's standards, and it's the Koch Brothers bus. And I approached the guy, and I said, this is the Koch Brothers bus, right? Do you know the Koch Brothers? Oh, no, I don't know who you're talking about. He's lying through his teeth. You see, both sides are manipulated. I mean, much of what the Tea Party stands for, I don't agree with. I mean, to me, it's just a bunch of conservatives that on some things they're right and some things they're very, very wrong.
Tommy, there's people in the movement. I don't agree with what they say.
Of course not. I disagree with about everybody some of the time.
But I have never wavered from my beliefs. Me and my husband both have given thousands of dollars in money and time and food and clothing to white families. We just had
Not attacking you as an individual. I mean, you see, number one, I'm not in a movement. I got out of the movement a long time ago. I am a lone wolf. I'm an independent person. I do what I think needs to be done. Other people should do the same thing. So I'm not attacking people for going to a Tea Party meeting, but there much of the time would be wasted as far as I'm concerned, because I've been through this kind of groups before. For 40 years I've been around these groups, and they never got anywhere. They wave their hands and yell and declare how unracist they are, and so I don't have time for them. I don't
see. Tommy, watch what they do. Don't watch what they say. What people say.
What are they doing?
Watch what people do. They only hang out with white people. They only marry and bed down with white people. They may say out in front, "I'm not a racist," but they don't have any black friends.
Well, there's a lot of groups. There's a lot of groups like that. They're not even political around. I know groups that are all white, but they're certainly not in my camp.
They've been conditioned to say that, and I'm not saying we're going to break through that conditioning, but I don't really go to them that often, to be honest with you, because we're in the process of moving.
Well, number one, they believe in political action, and political action's dead as a doornail. I mean, you're not going to vote this stuff out. It's too late for that. It's way too late for that.
You know that. I know that. You're 30 years ahead of these people. I'm 20 years ahead of these people, okay? We both know this.
Yes.
My only point was, the only reason I go to these meetings is I feel people out. There's probably only one or two people in the group that feel like we do. And then I have them over for dinner. I feel these people out. And like I said, I've known personally two people who've converted over from Tea Party mentality of loving the Jew and worshiping Israel to my side. So I'm saying that's not a lost cause, but you're not going to get the entire group, nor do I want the entire group on our side, because most of these people are too stupid to live.
Well, each individual has to work this thing out the way they see fit, and I'm not you, and I'm not where you're at, and I don't know the exact conditions. I go to meetings of the opposition. I'd rather go to extreme enemies on the other side and get into their meetings than spend time with the Tea Party, but I'm sure there's some good can be done, but it seems to me like an awful expenditure of time and energy to get very little return.
Well, I don't spend that much time on it. My only point was, when I left you that message a couple of months ago, is that when you call them teabaggers, you're really playing into the...
Well, I don't go out of my way. That's not my big deal. It's just, it comes across teabaggers, and I just read it off the news or whatever. What am I supposed to call them?
Fellow whites that are misguided.
Well, yeah, I do that all the time. But, I mean, if I'm communicating with Joe Blow on the street, he's going to say teabagger, you know?
Well, that's true. That's true. And when someone says that to me, I've had people say that to me.
Yeah.
And I've asked him, do you call people in the Jewish community kikes? Do you call people in La Raza sticks? Do you call people in the Black Panther niggers? Then why are you calling people of your own race or ethnicity? Why are you calling them a terrible word when they don't agree with what you say? I don't need to deride someone or denigrate someone just because they disagree with me.
Well,
especially on my own side.
Number one, 75% of the people don't think of any sexual connotations to the teabaggers. They think of the tea, throwing the tea over in revolutionary times more than that, and you should confront them that way. Say, yeah, our forefathers threw all that tea in the water. That's how we got the revolution going, and just bypass the other connotation. Most of the people I talk to never caught on to that connotation anyhow. It's just the extreme progressives that keep talking about it.
Okay, well, I think they know what they're doing. And
we should do like the Quakers did. That was an insult that they labeled the Quakers with, but they went right on and turned it into a positive thing and used it. So, I mean, you know, it's all the way you look at things. I wouldn't get all hung up on trying to get everybody to change over from teabagger. I think it's a silly word, and I think I know what you're talking about, and I think that's not good, but... they're stuck with it now. They use it. I mean, they use it. I mean, the teabaggers call themselves teabaggers.
Okay. I find the term offensive, but that's just me. And I'm not usually that easily offended, but that term bothers me. Because what that term connotates to me is the media blames the Tea Party for everything. Now, apparently they have no power, but yet they do. And we were just at a local gun show over the weekend, and I spoke to a couple of them.
Yeah.
In fact, one recognized me.
Yeah.
And asked me what I was up to, and I said, we're moving out of the area. And I said, I can't take it here anymore. She said, yeah, I understand. She said, we're having our exit strategy as well. Because in South Florida, Tommy, the economy is not doing that well.
Well, I mean, you got massive cheap labor coming in from all over the place. The whole southern Florida is moving north. Eventually, Florida will be a third world state. Atlanta is going to be the capital of the black nation and the whole bit. And if you're in between there in the panhandle, you're going to get squashed. So I was telling people that 20 years ago. They ought to get out of there while they can.
I'm not from here. I married into it, unfortunately. So,
but there's a hell of a lot of bad places to go. So it's pretty hard to figure out some place where you're not going to be overwhelmed. I mean, I've got I'm here in this little town that's mostly white, but within 2 miles of me, they've got a trailer park full of Mexicans. You know, so I still have to look at the bastards coming by my house every morning. You know.
Yeah, but Tommy, as things start to deteriorate, and they're going to, they could deteriorate very rapidly. I know you've got to go, so I just wanted to call you and make
sure.
That point about the Tea Party, because I personally know people in these Tea Party meetings that I correspond with either through text messaging or phone or email almost on a daily basis. Now, they don't really go to the meetings anymore. They went to them very sporadically like I did, and some of them may be your radio subscribers. So all I'm saying is think of the other side. That's all I'm asking.
Well, I always think of the other side, and then I weigh the situation. But I think if you'd run my radio show back to these people that you've converted, they'd probably reconvert.
Yeah.
We can't handle it. It's too much for us. It's too rich a meat for us. Well, anyhow, whoever you can get in there that, whatever you're going to call it, that will say the hell with voting and all that kind of stuff and get ready for the big war, fine with me. I surely wouldn't oppose that. And like I say, I don't I'm not a guru and I'm not a dictator, and I'm simply one guy who says what I think, you know.
I know.
Okay?
All right, Tommy, 14-5.
14-5, Janet. Bye.
Okay, bye.
Well, technically, that worked out pretty good. So maybe that's the way we'll do it instead of trying to elaborate a big board here to do this. If you call in and I'm here in the bunker, I'll pause my show that I'm putting together, and then I'll talk to you. I'll put it on a tape, and then I'll edit it into the show. I think that would work out pretty good. So those of you who want to call in and bitch and moan about terrible timing, here's your chance. This is going to be the line, either to leave a message that you don't necessarily want to be on the radio, or a message that you want me to put on the radio. So anyhow, that's the way we'll do it. And Janet is a good gal. I've known her for quite some time. I know she still calls in up on Wolf Wall Street's show on Sunday and goes on and on. She does have a way of going on and on. She's pretty much out of this right-wing conservative thing, but she still has, I think, a little bit of a propensity to slide back into it. Anyhow, I wasn't at that tea party meeting. She's got me saying it. I wasn't saying tea bag. All of a sudden, she got me saying tea bag. Tea party. Their meeting was here a couple of years ago, and I went there and had that confrontation with the guy on the bus, of which the rest of the people there didn't know a damn thing about it. They didn't know who Koch brothers were or anything, which shows how much homework they do. And, of course, they consider everything the left progressive says all lies. Well, that's not true any more than everything the right-wing conservative says all lies. You got to listen and evaluate. But I was approached right away. A couple of guys giving me all kinds of hell, and I was talking about the working class and labor and that stuff, and I don't exactly remember what. I had it on a tape someplace, but they were climbing all over me in this tea party meeting. And if I show up at these, there's another group around here that are affiliated with the Tea Party people. I can't think of the name right now. They meet in a church out here, and I've gone there to two or three of their meetings and just sit with my mouth shut and listen to them. And but there's no friendliness at all. There's no, "Hi, Tom, your opinion is valuable to us, and we may disagree with you, but you're welcome to come." There's none of that. It's a total cold shoulder, just like try to go to a Democrat meeting around here, and they move the meeting, so I don't even know where it's at. And then I told you before, the last time I tried to go to a Republican meeting around here, they actually barred me from entering the door. So this stuff of trying to work with these kind of people, to me, is just a waste of time. I'd far more feel effective finding a B'nai B'rith meeting or a left-wing meeting, Jewish-controlled group meeting, a political meeting with some lying son of a bitch and senator or something like that. I think I get more out of something like that than I would following the Tea Party around. Because the Tea Party is, there's some of the things they do is not right. And so I'm not going to go along with that. And most of the stuff they're talking about is simply the same old right-wing conservative stuff we've listened to for years and years. So anyhow, let's get on with the revolution, boys and girls. Civil war, uprising, Occupy Now, whatever it is, but we can't keep doing this same old crap over and over again. Of course, the other thing, too, is that Tea Party stuff, I shit you not, they'll stand around praying for over a half an hour, sometimes 45 minutes, with two or three preachers coming in before they get to the meat of the meeting. and I don't have time to screw around with people so idiotic they believe in spooks in the sky. I won't go and, you know, intentionally just insult them, and I may just keep my mouth shut, but I am not going to subject my brain and the limited time I have left to listening to this baby Jesus crap. It's just a waste of time, and it just pains me to know that millions and millions of people are into that trap. They're slaves. They're religious slaves, man. Well, let's close out the show today with a little reading from Siege and our buddy James Mason. James, call me. I haven't heard from you in years. Anyhow, defining the radical extreme, the question of who and which is the farthest out, for what reasons and towards what purpose. Among these types would be included all the pioneers, the groundbreakers, the innovators, the courageous, the outrageous, the unpopular, the unprofitable, the dangerous, the controversial, the misunderstood, and those in advance of their times. It's been said that the road of excess leads to the palace of wisdom, that the only aberration is abstention. What all of this does on the practical side amounts to the elimination of the surprise element, minimizes the chance of disillusionment, builds confidence and self-reliance, and helps gain for one the mastery of almost any situation. It also rids us of the cowards and fakers, as well as the opportunists, as they can't use it or hide behind it. We can tolerate being regarded as inhibiting the far reaches of the outer limits if it means never being caught, dragged behind anyone else. It behooves us to smile at those who today disparage our message, if by our so doing we are striking out on the course that they themselves must one day follow. We would be fools and cowards to shirk the task and take for granted that someone else might take up in our stead. We have so little to lose at this point and so much to gain, our prime enemies being stagnation, dogma, and muddle. It requires some daring and imagination to become the vanguard of a movement or a struggle, and to remain so takes constant reappraisal and reevaluation, something the right wing never learned to do. Had not Commander Rockwell taken the bull by the horns and risked everything in his good name as a conservative over 20 years ago, and now it's 40 years at least, where today would be the racialist struggle in the United States? Where would it be? What was in 1960 the most dynamic and futuristic thinking today is shared by practically one and all. But it was only through the supreme sacrifice of one man who was able to see farther than the rest in his own time. And still, the situation demands more, far more. We could easily have another 20 years of marching ahead of us, but it cannot be directionless marching, and it cannot be marching in circles. I might add, it can't be a firing squad in a circle either. People like to stay with what's comfortable, especially those with a broad conservative right-wing streak in them. People dislike the shit disturbers. However, comfort and routine do not make revolution. Where once Gus Hall was a firebrand with the power to shock the pants off all of us, today's an old fogey. And Gus Hall was the head of the American Communist Party for decades. Seems as though all our real National Socialist leaders die in battle before they get the chance to atrophy thus. Maybe we are blessed in that manner. What we want and what we believe we have achieved is to make the NSLF synonymous with the radical extreme, and when you seek to define the radical extreme, you need only recite those four letters to have it completely summed up. Now, this was written in 1982 in July. The NSLF was the National Socialist Liberation Front, which came out of Joe Tomasi, which was a great move forward. And unfortunately, the premature death of Joe screwed it up. But it did. It was a great idea because it was taking a lot of the positions of the left and also even the type operations and stepping away from the right wing. In an October-November issue of the National Sheriff's Magazine, there appears an article entitled Posse Comitatus, Threat of the County-Based Criminal Militarist, unquote. The article is remarkable not only because the entire front cover of that issue is devoted to it, or because it is of exceptional length, or because it reads like something out of the good old days of the radical right, but because it focuses attention on what has to be considered a genuine ray of light on the otherwise dark and dreary scene. It was written by one Philip C. McGuire, who is the Assistant Director of Criminal Enforcement of the BATF, the Federal Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and so on. And so we may accept this as a top of the run from the system point of view. Given within the article is the genesis of Posse Comitatus, including the names, dates, places, and relevance to its birth and development. The blazing incident involving Gordon Call is given the space and attention it is due, an explanation of what Posse Comitatus means and stands for, which couldn't fail to appeal to the right kind of person, is included. The movement accusation against the Jews is given. The familiar movement groups and publications are listed in connection. An outstanding and highly technical listing of armament recommended by the Posse Comitatus is recreated at length. To properly appreciate the flavor of the article, it is useful to quote the final two paragraphs in their entirety. You know, this is similar to what they say about Lone Wolf today, is what they said about Posse Comitatus back, 25 years ago, 30 years ago, which was a great idea, and but they went to a certain point, and it didn't seem to proceed beyond that point. I mean, they were involved in a lot of action, but the fire didn't spread far enough, fast enough. Based on the above information, it is apparent that certain members of the PC Posse, a clear and dangerous threat to society, their reported philosophy of racism and anti-Jewism, and their total disrespect for non-elected law enforcement officers must be a major concern to all law enforcement agencies. Care must be taken when confronting these members to ensure that we do not look upon them as just another tax protester. They have proven that they will injure and kill law enforcement officers in the furtherance of their cause. Recall that between February 13, 1983 and June 3, 1983, Gordon Call and other members of the North Dakota PC killed three law enforcement officers and wounded an additional three officers, unquote. Well, too bad it wasn't a lot more. They deserved it. Quote, if you have any questions concerning potential firearms and explosive violations in your area, or if you need assistance in conducting firearms and explosive investigations against members of these types of groups, please contact your nearest ATF office for assistance. There is a special hatred and, yes, fear in my heart for the IRS. Their blood-sucking touched off a near calamity here 2 years ago, starting at the time and increasingly ever since. My wits in that area have pulled about even with the sharpness of theirs, and so red-hot confrontation with them is not in the offing. Stave the system off where possible. Rip it off where possible. Attack it where it's possible. But this has not been the case with others, Gordon Call most notably, and according to the news on television the other night, it was not the case with about 800 people last year alone. These were reported as violent attacks or assaults against agents of the IRS. As a result, the agents are now packing guns. That is, if they weren't before, and as though they need an excuse now. Well, Tommy went through this. I was into that tax rebellion in the early 70s up to my neck, working with Colonel Gale in California, Bob Miles in Michigan, many others. In fact, I was heavy into that before I became really hardcore racial. That's where I met with hardcore racial people, was in the tax rebellion moving, party meetings. Self-defense, it was referred to as on television. Robbers is a fit term for them, but not even vampire approaches the depth of vileness and contemptibility they maintain. 800 people defending themselves last year against what are now armed robbers, and the system was surprised and maddened when they didn't simply fork over their earnings without a mutter of protest. Now, it's interesting to compare that with what we've got today, which is 1,000 times worse with the Patriot situation, as so-called. Forget what you call it, but anyhow. What maddens me is why to date not more deaths on the side of the system. The number 800 approximates the number of movement hardcore members of about 15 years ago. And it takes pretty hardcore customer to buck up against those vampires in a three-piece suit. Who are these people? Where did these incidents take place? Are they all in federal prison now? They are unknown, unnamed, and most certainly unorganized. 800 is a number that can be seen as large in some respects, but small in others. But these 800 skipped the preliminaries and came directly into conflict with the enemy itself. That is purely revolutionary, whether they realize it or not. Anyway, it got the news. Let their numbers increase 100-fold, and the revolution will be won. Just a little more here. The hell of it is that we ourselves aren't at all immune from the horrific things that are in store for the future. If we were somehow isolated and insulated from it, then none of what's happening today would bring it on, would bother or concern us. If that was the case, I doubt whether we'd be in a struggle at all. But this is not a laboratory experiment that we can shelve, lock up, and walk away from. This is a fight for survival, and we are not immune from the hell that we must strive to see gets broken loose. Any halfway normal person might be expected to come up with a rejoinder like this. Why do we do it? We do it because one thing is clear. The current deadlock must be broken at all costs. It is frighteningly obvious that nothing positive can be expected to happen with the way things are now. Therefore, a different atmosphere must be created in which some kind of positive change can be effected. Again, the normal person might say that there is already enough disorder, enough hell and chaos going on right now without adding more. What they don't see is that we have in this country is an ordered disorder, which was made to order by and for Big Brother. Don't you believe they could stop crime, subversion, and anarchy if they really wanted to? All the hell and disorder of the past and the general crime wave today is the greatest help to Big Brother, his system, and his establishment. The Black Riots gave the insurance companies carte blanche to remove the gloves and start extorting small businessmen and all the rest of us. The limited anarchy and the limited insurrection of the blacks and reds just gave Big Brother more alibi to tighten the lid of this electronic surveillance society, to stampede legislation to disarm the population. All the runaway non-white crime merely gives cover and justification for the erection of a police state. The reign of power firmly in the hands of the Jews. They don't want it stamped out. They need it for the completion of their plans. What they fear most is total disorder, which they cannot control. That which they can't monitor or control doesn't serve their interests. It's been said that we don't want to rock the boat. We want to sink it. When we succeed in blowing the bottom right out, we're going to have to hurry topside over the rail and swim for life, leaving the rats to drown with the sheep, with the ship. And that was James Mason, April 1981. Well, I'm sure if he could be here today, he'd be saying, boy, I'll tell you, it's been amplified. The problems have been amplified by a thousand times. Homeland Security and all this. We're now pretty close. We're moving into this real total police state. And so, and then considering worldwide economics and all that kind of stuff, I say, we're right on course. I think, I don't like to put dates on anything, but I think within the next 10 years, maybe 20, the bottom's going to blow on this thing. But we have learned that we cannot fight it head on. We've had several of our friends attempt that, and they were courageous, brave people. And we take nothing away from their sacrifice. But we now realize that this system is so rotten that it's got to run its course most of the way to where it just can't, until everything is just gone to shit, to be perfectly honest. And then it'll be time for our game. Then it'll be time for our game. In the meantime, just prepare. Ideologically, that's the main thing. Main thing is to have your head right. And not so much storing this and storing that, and I'm going to be here, and, if they come, I'm going to blast them, all that attitude, that right-wing attitude. The thing now is to steel yourself in your ideology as a fanatic. And I use that word in a good way, fanatic. And so when your time comes and you see your opening, you'll know when to take it. That's it for today. I'll be back with you tomorrow, which will be Thor's Day. And 14-5, and keep your powder dry and keep your brain agile, I'll tell you. Things are getting interesting. The worse it gets, like I say, worse is better for now. When the conservatives cry, we laugh and rejoice.
Furies howl, let the heavens thunder roll. The earth crack right beneath my feet, swallow up my soul. The devil, his own self, come scratching at my door. Here I stand, I will not run no more. Well, there's demons in the darkness, like wolves out in the night. Hear them all around me, Lord, the circle's closing time. I got nowhere to run to, and I wouldn't if I could. My stake is in the ground, it's just a simple cross of wood. I am a child of God's own hand. Claim my right to his sweet love, and here I take my stand. Shepherd left the 99 to find that little stray. Found him on the cliffside, snatched him from the rocks below. So shepherd, please don't leave me, you've got one more sheep to go. I am a child of God's own hand. Claim my right to his sweet love, and here I take my stand.
child, God's own hand. Claim my right to his sweet love, and here I take my stand.
Well, I have to excuse that one. I didn't realize that had that Jesus stuff in it. But it's some good picking on that banjo, I guess it was. Anyhow, okay. Now, look, starting about 10 o'clock in the morning, when I really get seriously into the basement, you can call me on that number, 574-267-5036. And if you got something intelligent to say, I'll put it on the tape, and we'll run it into the show. I'm usually here from, you know, seriously in here from 10 o'clock to about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Sometimes not quite that long. But don't worry, I'm doing other things too, okay? So that's it. Later.